I have a very special treat for you today. Today, I am going to be speaking with Dr. Benjamin Carney, who is an associate professor in the UCLA Department of Psychology, an adjunct behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation, and one of the founders of the magnificent and wonderful Relationship Institute, which is part of UCLA. Dr. Carney, thank you so much for being here and speaking with me today.
My pleasure, Marnie. Thanks for having me.
So just to give a bit of background, I stumbled upon Dr. Carney randomly when I was doing some research on social psychology focusing on male and female interactions. And so I arranged to have a call with him, and we ended up having a great conversation last week, and I stopped him halfway through because I realized that I wanted to share this information with my users. I think it's really valuable, wonderful information about attraction and the skills required to sustain a healthy relationship. And so that's what I'm doing now because, as you know, Dr. Carney, at the Wing Girl Method, we focus a lot of our time on attraction and why people are attracted to others. And so I really wanted to know what your thoughts are on, number one, why people are attracted, and number two, what are women particularly attracted to?
Well, you know, we could spend days and days on this. Certainly people have been wondering for centuries about those very questions.
Exactly.
But, you know, it really breaks down to a couple different questions when you think hard about it. And scholars who've studied attraction have broken it down in this way. There's the things that make other people pleasant. You know, there's the things we like in our friends or that sort of make other people, people want to spend time with generally.
Right.
And then there's romantic or sexual attraction, and that's kind of a different beast.
Okay.
So, you know, we tend to like people who are similar to us.
Okay.
Generally. More
is that for both sexual attraction and for just friendship attraction as well, that we do tend to like people who are similar to ourselves?
Yeah, so you can think of it this way, sort of like there's the biggest cone is all the things that make someone generally attractive.
Okay.
And similarity is a big one. You know, we tend to be attracted to people who are similar to us, but that means attracted as friends or as colleagues we'd like to work with and as romantic partners.
Okay.
Generally, the people that we're attracted to romantically are often, not always, but often a subset of the people that we generally find pleasant in the world.
Okay.
So, you know, as much as you ask people, you know, what do you find attractive, or another way that people have done these studies is you sort of give people choices. Who would you like to hang out with? And you present people with sort of hypothetical others, and you give them certain information about those other people. And you just see who do people choose. Similar.
Well, actually, you and I had talked about a study that was performed. I think in Wisconsin, I may be making that up. But you said there was a study done where they asked people to actually write down what it was that they wanted or that they were attracted to. I actually forget what the actual study was. But
well,
it was,
so we were talking about
speed dating.
The interesting thing is exactly right. It was a study that used speed dating to examine a particular issue, which is this. Do people know what it is that they want, especially from a sexual or romantic partner? And the reason this question came up is that there have been a lot of studies that simply asked men and women, what are the top three things you look for? What are the top things you look for? That study's been done, you know, maybe 100 different times.
Yeah.
And the results are always the same. Everybody says, I want someone who's good-looking. Now we're talking about sexual and romantic attraction. Everyone says, I want someone who's
okay.
good looking, but men say it more than women.
Okay.
Everyone wants it, but men say, I want it more than women do.
Okay.
And everyone says, I want someone who's friendly. No gender differences there. And women, much more than men, are more likely to say, you know, I want someone who kind of has some stature, has some earning potential, like has a job. Men are much less interested in their partners having a job.
Yeah.
But women are interested, like, hey, I want to know that you have a job, that you're a man in society.
Okay.
So that's easy to find. Any researcher can tell you that men and women differ on the things they say they want. And men are also much more likely to focus on specific body parts that they like in a partner. women are much less likely to mention specific body parts when they talk about who they're romantically attracted to. But this is the interesting part. The interesting part is that someone said, well, is what men and women say that they want predicting the choices they actually make when they're in a dating situation? And here's how they examined this question. They set up their own speed dating event. In fact, they set up a series of these speed dating events. And you know about your users probably know about speed dating, which is, you know, you're in a big room, there's members of the opposite sex, and everyone circles around and talks for about 4 minutes to each other person in the room.
Yeah.
So you don't have to go on a whole date. Well, the researchers set this up, and beforehand they asked everybody thoughts and questionnaires, men and women. And the men, and everyone was asked the same question, which is, okay, how important is physical attractiveness? How important is friendliness? And how important is kind of earning potential? And they got exactly the results that you'd expect. Men said, oh, physical attractiveness is really important. Women less so. Women said, earning potential is really important. Men less so. And everybody thought friendliness was important. And then they went and they did the speed dating. And each person, after every specific conversation, rated their partner on these three things. Attractiveness, mm-hmm. physical attractiveness, earning potential, and friendliness. And then at the very end of the night, everyone was asked, okay, who do you want to date? Who do you want to date in the room? And here's the interesting part. You'd expect, in a rational world, in a world that made sense, that if I tell you before the study, before the speed dating event, that the only thing that matters to me is physical attractiveness, and then I go into a room and I rate the physical attractiveness of every single person I talk to, and then you ask me who I want to date, I should say I want to date the people I thought were the most physically attractive.
Exactly.
But that's not what they found. You'd think that if I, beforehand, I said, you know what really matters to me is earning potential. And then you send me to a room and I ask and I rate every single person for what I think is their earning potential. And then you ask me who I want to date. I should date the people who I thought had the best earning potential.
Exactly.
But that's not what they found.
What did they find?
What they found is that what people said was important to them did not in any way help them to predict who people wanted to date after these conversations.
Okay. But then what does that mean? What does that mean? That people are going after the wrong things in life because they're directing themselves toward things that they think that they want when they actually want something else? Or what do you think that study actually means?
That's a really good question. And the researchers asked the same question. And the answer isn't necessarily clear, but what's emerging is this, that we know generally what we want. But the truth is that there's lots of people who sort of fit within a guidelines of acceptability. You know, there's lots of people who are good-looking enough and successful enough.
Right.
But what we don't have a lot of access to is, or at least haven't thought a lot about as a society, is that a lot of whether you're really romantically attracted to someone is not connected to their qualities as individuals. That's actually not where romantic attraction necessarily happens. It might be where good relationships happen, but it's not where romantic attraction happens. People are thinking of romantic attraction as like a chemistry set. Like, oh, I'm looking for someone who has these elements, and if you find the people who have the right elements, then bang, you're going to have romantic attraction. That's not the case. It turns out that romantic attraction is more like a dance between two people, and if the dance goes right, that's where romantic attraction is. What the research discovered is whether I wanted to date somebody or not wasn't a function of their quality as an individual. It was a function of how the interaction unfolded. What actually happened in those 4 minutes made all the difference. And it overwhelmed the role of physical attractiveness or earning potential or what have you. Who do I want to date? I think that I want attractive people, but ultimately, I want people who made me feel good when I talked to them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Who do I want to date? I think I like earning potential, but more importantly, I like someone who, when we talked, I got a charge out of it. I walked away a little bit excited or aroused, or something happened in the interaction, in the discussion. That's what makes it all happen, more than the qualities of the individual.
Okay.
Now, this isn't totally news to a lot of people, but it was news to scholars. And it was a different way of thinking about where romantic attraction starts. It's because a lot of like the dating sites and the matchmaking sites say, oh, we will find the person who's well-suited for you. But you know what? You can find 20
people.
It's based
on qualities, right? It's based on qualities.
Exactly, Marnie.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Qualities. But that's not where it happens. It happens, and that interaction, if that's really where it happens, that's not something you can necessarily predict.
Exactly.
But it is something that, you know, there are other people, the people who are writing books now about how to have these interactions in a way that makes you more successful at connecting. I think that's kind of what your site is doing a little bit, too.
That's 100% what it is that we're doing at the Lean Girl Method. We want to teach people how to become the most attractive version of themselves so that they can dance with as many people as possible.
Yeah. And presumably, and you know, that's a way to find the right person would be to present yourself well so that when that right person comes along, the interaction will go well.
Exactly. Because a lot of people don't actually reveal their real character until later on down the road because they're shy or they're not confident or they have approach anxiety. So a lot of people don't get to see that there are hundreds of possible options around them at all times. They keep it covered up.
You know,
that's my belief.
I think you may be right about that. I would also say, you know, people are so complicated. I don't know about the idea of a real character. You know, a lot of research on personality shows that people might well be really shy in one context, bold in another context, confident in one kind of situation, but genuinely withdrawn in another kind of situation. None of those things is their real character. It's the whole thing. The whole pattern is their real character.
Interesting.
But
okay.
It means it's hard to get to know somebody because you only get to know them in one context.
That's true. No, you're absolutely correct about that.
One of the reasons why relationships frequently start between people who, you know, interact on other levels, who work together, who go to school together. That's a great place to meet somebody because they are exposed to lots of different parts of your character. It's not and you have lots of opportunities to interact with them, and it's not just around the dating itself.
Okay. But what about people? For the Wing Girl Method, I encourage people to join groups, but they have more of the opportunities that you're talking about. Like if they join groups, they see people on a regular basis, and other people can become more exposed to their character in on many different levels. But what about for people who are interacting for one single night at a bar or one single, 10-minute segment at the grocery store? How can people create or tap into that attraction in those scenarios?
Okay.
I know that's a big question to be asking, and I'm looking for, like, a small answer, and I know it's a much larger answer than that, but in your opinion.
Okay. It's a big question.
Yeah.
Well, in my opinion, the general advice that you give, which is, get out of the house.
Yeah.
Do things. Do activities. Where you're interacting with people generally and regularly, that seems like great advice. Because it means there's going to be more interactions and more chances for you to be exposed to people, and particularly people that you might like.
Exactly.
So the implication of that is that one-time encounter is generally going to be tough. That's a tough situation to try to meet somebody, especially women, because women have... There's two things that men should be aware of in the short term when they're trying to meet women from a single encounter. One is, and it doesn't take a genius to figure this out, women have in our society every reason to be suspicious of men that they don't know. There's generally reasons to believe that men are threatening to women in a way that women are not to men. Men rape women. Men Strange men are strange, and I would advise my women friends to stay away from
them. Exactly. No, I say the exact same thing. It's very difficult, and people do have walls up because of all of the evidence that's out there of possible things that could happen.
Yeah. So if you're trying to meet a woman, like, in the supermarket, as a man, you're at a tremendous disadvantage, because if she's a smart woman, she's saying, wait, you know what? Strange men are dangerous. I should stay away. That's why you're at a disadvantage compared to, let's say, someone I work with who I know. Oh, I can interact with you many times. I know that you're safe, that you're really a genuinely good guy. You're not some kind of creep.
Exactly.
But let's say you can overcome that.
Okay.
Once you overcome that, now the issue is that the question that rises then is, okay, well, how do you sort of make a connection with somebody of the opposite sex? There have been some studies that have done anthropological work in bars.
Really?
Yes. So the same way that an anthropologist might go into the jungle and observe a tribe of gorillas and look at their mating behavior, anthropologists have gone into human being bars and observed the mating behavior of the human species. And here are some of their observations. It's great work. For example, and some of their observations really questions conventional wisdom. So, for example, here's a question for you, Marty. Which gender is most likely to initiate interactions between men and women in a bar?
Men.
Obviously men. Yeah. But the anthropologists have pointed out something really, really interesting, at least in one study, that although men were the first person to make verbal contact, in the majority of cases, the anthropologists were able to identify that the woman had actually signaled interest prior to the man's approach.
Interesting. Okay. And that's actually what a lot of my clients talk about. They always ask me about the signals to look for in women that a woman's interested. So it's true. It's when women do give them the eyes or whatever the signals are that I tell them to look for, that is when a man approaches. That's interesting.
And the eye contact is exactly what these researchers pointed out. They said that women were actually very good in a bar setting of scanning the room with your eyes and holding a gaze. So you scan your room with your eyes, and if your eye falls on somebody who you like, holding the gaze just a little bit extra, a couple seconds extra, and that was, for receptive men, a signal to approach, a signal that their approach would be received well.
Okay.
And in the majority of cases in this one study, it was actually that kind of nonverbal contact on the woman that really was the first stage of the interaction, which then the man responded to. And you can see that's already a dance, isn't it?
Yeah.
She does something, he notices and responds. And she says, oh, he noticed and responded. That feels good. And then he says, oh, how are you doing? And she responds, that feels good. And suddenly there's an interaction which can, you know, produce this kind of romantic attraction.
Okay.
Another anthropological observation about these bars. These are observations by people who are the same people who study animals, non-human. They're saying this, look, the task of mating is to send three messages. One message is, I'm here. I'm in the room. The second message is, you have to advertise your gender and your availability.
Interesting.
Third message is you have to advertise your interest in a particular individual.
Yeah,
and they've pointed out. What's that? Say again.
That's very interesting. That is what I teach, not using that wording, because I was going to ask you the question: what makes a woman want to look over at somebody and give him that signal to come?
Well, in a heterosexual setting, what they've pointed out is that men have to establish, first of all, their gender, and women do too. So when women and men go to bars, they tend to emphasize their gender. So women are going to wear something that emphasizes their hair, their curves, their bodies, and men are going to emphasize their gender in slightly different ways, by walking in, by punching a friend on the shoulder, by playing pool and being good at it, by playing darts, or something that says, hey, I am an attractive man. I'm a man, I'm attractive, and I'm present in this room.
I'm ready to go.
I'm ready to go. So, yes. And again, what the observation is that men and women do this in different ways. So women are in the bar drawing attention to their hair, flipping their hair, wearing jewelry. These are all ways of drawing attention to their female characteristics. And men are in the bar laughing loudly, telling big jokes, sort of bantering aggressively with other males, which is a way of advertising, hey, I'm a bit of a dominant guy, I'm a confident guy, I'm a capable guy.
Yeah, and I'm a leader.
I mean, you'd expect these things to be especially important in a bar relative to, like, in a work set.
Exactly.
And this is another really interesting thing that has been studied is that the evolutionary psychologists have said what won't come as a surprise to any of the users of your site, which is, men are much more interested in, like, short-term flings and one-night stands than women.
Exactly, yeah.
No surprise there. That's old news. But
yeah.
the question is, when would women also be interested in a one-night stand? Or in, a sexual fling? Because
yeah.
Women have. Under what circumstances do women have? Turns out that both men and women are capable of what the scholars call long-term strategies and short-term strategies.
Mm-hmm.
Long-term being sort of the strategy of trying to get into a long-term committed relationship, and short-term being the strategy of trying to basically hook up with someone or have sex with them, and without the expectation of a long-term relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that men and women both engage in these behaviors. Of course they do.
Yeah.
But for different reasons.
Really? Okay, I'm one of those reasons.
Oh, there we go. So this is interesting. So
yeah.
When you ask men, what are your standards? What would it take to have a long-term relationship with a woman? What kind of woman would this have to be? Men say, oh, very high standards. For me to be in a long-term committed relationship, my standards are super high. Okay, men, what are your standards for being in a short-term fling, a sexual fling, one-night stand? Oh, very low. I don't need anything.
Yeah.
For women, it's somewhat the opposite.
Really?
Yeah. Well, if you ask women, what would it take to be in a long-term relationship? They also say, oh, very high standards for a long-term relationship, sure. Okay, what about a short-term relationship? In some ways, not everywhere, but in some ways, their standards for a short-term relationship, they have a lot to lose, are high, higher than for a long-term relationship. So if you ask, there's been research on women.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, you have a choice between two guys. One guy is a powerful, muscular, but somewhat unreliable guy, but very good-looking and dominant and muscular.
Yeah.
And here's another guy who is dependable, reliable, but a little bit shorter and not as muscular.
Okay.
Which one?
Well, I already know which one I would choose. For and I think any other woman would make the same choice.
Wait, tell me again your choice, Maury.
The more muscular guy. If I'm going to have a one-night stand or make out with somebody, I want somebody who, it doesn't really matter if they're reliable, because I'm not going to know if they're reliable, because it's not going to go any further than that.
Exactly. So women, for women, the standards for attractiveness and dominance actually go up for the one-night stand. They're like, oh, for a long-term relationship, I'd be willing to settle for a guy who is reliable, even if he isn't sort of gorgeous or dominant or especially manly. But for a one-night stand, I better be getting something out of it. He better be really gorgeous or really exciting.
Exactly. Oh, that makes sense. That makes complete sense.
So the men, I mean, knowing this, it seems to me, would help men who use your site to ask some important questions, which is, what setting am I in? And the women who I'm trying to meet, what kind of relationship are they likely to be looking for today? And then who am I? And what do I fit into? So if I'm in a bar, and it's a singles bar, and there's women who are, like, clearly looking for a one-night stand or just to have some fun, well, their standards for masculinity, dominance, are going to be higher. Because that's what happens to women. Whereas in the same bar, men's standards go down. Men's standards are like, you know what? It's a fling. I don't care. My standards are lower than they normally are.
Okay.
In contrast, though, if men are looking for a long-term relationship, and when women are looking for a long-term relationship, they're much more likely to focus on a broader set of criteria. When women are looking for a long-term relationship, they focus on a broader set of criteria and are more flexible for things like attractiveness and manliness and other issues like reliability, dependability, emotional sensitivity come into play.
Which is why, well, actually, I'm out with a lot of my clients, and they'll point at a very attractive woman and say, and with her boyfriend or husband, who is obviously not as attractive, they'll say, "How did he get her? It makes no sense to them, but I'm like, I totally get it. You see how he's walking? Do you see, like, the potential with his man? That's the thing. A lot of men can't see that in other men.
Yeah, that may be true, because men are not trained, straight men are not trained to look for that.
Exactly, for those qualities. They don't understand it. All they see is a very beautiful woman or a quality woman with a man who's not as attractive.
Yeah, there are compensations. There's other things that men bring to the party or to the relationship that make it equitable. So, evolutionary perspective say one of the resources women bring to relationships is their attractiveness. That's something that men value hugely, and so that's considered a sort of a resource on the women's side. Because women don't care that much about it in a long-term relationship. They care less about it. They still care, but they care less. Men bring other resources to the relationship, like their earning potential, like their ability to protect and care for a family.
Mm-hmm.
But those calculations change in a bar. When women are looking for a short-term fling, which they do, clearly, my point is just that then they have a different set of standards.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem for men is that if that's what you're looking for, women's standards there are higher, and it should be higher. Because women who run the risk of being raped or the risk of getting pregnant, those are very bad risks. And
exactly.
Then they're bigger risks for women than for men. So the rewards have to be higher for women than for men. Higher. Mm-hmm. And the standards are higher, too.
So basically you're saying if you want to find a partner, don't look for it in a bar if you're looking for a long-term relationship.
That's great. Perfect summary. If you're looking for a long-term relationship, don't look for it in a bar.
Yeah. And that makes complete sense. And even though you still can find it at a bar, you're just saying that your expectations are very different when you're out and about at a bar. But it was interesting what you were talking about men presenting themselves in a certain way. I talk to a lot of my clients who, when they walk into a social setting, whether it be a bar or a seminar or even their office, a lot of them live inside of their head because they are not completely confident, comfortable people. They become awkward, they have approach anxiety, and that behavior will ultimately stop them from, what my understanding of what you're saying, will stop them from being noticed, because you can't act like a man, and you can't, I forget what the other couple of things were that you said, but you can't present those three things that you had mentioned if you're living inside of your head in a strange place that nobody can access except for you.
That's certainly true. I think we were talking about expressing yourself as dominant, expressing yourself as confident, and that's a tough thing to pretend. You know, like if you aren't, if you just generally don't feel dominant and don't feel confident, well, that's going to be tough.
Mm-hmm.
Men are going to look more attractive when they're in their comfort zone. And
exactly.
For men for whom a bar isn't a comfort zone, or like an explicit dating setting isn't a comfort zone, well, they're not going to look their best. So,
exactly.
So what are you going to do? Well, there's two ways. One is make it your comfort zone. Train,
exactly.
Somehow, expose, and just get comfortable. That's very tough, though.
That's what I teach men how to do. It's actually take an uncomfortable space and make it comfortable. And that's through practice. That's through learning the skills that you need to be comfortable in that space.
That seems like a very good thing to try to do, and it's going to be challenging.
Because, yes, definitely.
You know, if you have another, every time you have a failure experience, that's going to make the next time a little bit harder. But a success experience will make the next time a little easier.
Exactly.
the other advice that you were talking about seems also pretty good, which is
thanks.
Potential partners, when you're in your comfort zone, they're going to see the best part of you. They're going to see you at your most confident. Most people in life do have areas where they feel good and confident. It may not be the dating setting. It may be some other setting, maybe the work setting or some other hobby or interest that you have where you do feel like, hey, I know myself, I know my capabilities, and I feel good here.
And I know what I'm talking about.
And I know what I'm talking about. That's a place where you're going to look attractive. That's where you are attractive.
And a lot of the clients that I talk with, if they are uncomfortable, I go on outings with them. So I work with them one-on-one in a social scenario and ask them to interact with people so that I can watch them and see how they carry themselves so that I get to see how other women are responding to them. And so for a lot of them, to get them comfortable, I ask them, what is your hobby? What's the one thing in life that you absolutely love? They tell me, and then I say, fine, well, talk to me about it for 5 minutes. And just the fact that they know so much about one topic gets them to calm down, relax, and then I ask them to remember how that comfortable feeling felt. And next time that they get anxious, go back to that comfortable place, say a sentence in that whole monologue that you just gave to me so that you can trigger yourself to calm down. And I find that really works with a lot of people. And it's over time that they acquire that skill that they can do it naturally on their own. But I think you're absolutely right with what you're saying. Like, the more comfortable you are in a situation, the better you're going to appear to other people.
So you and I are focused on, well, I think, where we should be, which is the interaction. The interaction where chemistry happens or it doesn't. And I think the advice you're giving makes a lot of sense, which is sort of try to feel confident and do what you can to remind yourself of your own capabilities in that moment. Yeah. There's another route, it seems to me, to making that interaction go well. And this is, I'm thinking now of research by some colleagues at the University of Rochester who talk about the process of developing intimacy in an interaction. And I don't mean sexual intimacy. I really sort of mean an emotional connection.
Yeah.
And they're saying that that emotional connection arises from somebody disclosing something about themselves and then feeling understood.
Yes.
But that's
especially
a very, very powerful feeling in an interaction.
Yeah.
So you can imagine that one way to create that feeling is to ask a question.
Exactly.
And you know, when in doubt, when you've got nothing to say, you can always ask a question.
Yeah.
And listen to the answer.
That's what I was going to say. But you must listen to the response. A lot of the clients that I work with, they ask questions. They fire them out like crazy, but they forget to listen to the response. And so they're already on to their next question before they can actually contribute to the conversation they created.
Now, that's exactly what has been studied, is the way this process unfolds. And people have done research on these interactions by observing pairs, couples, really talking. I've noticed that it takes more than just asking a question, as you say. You have to ask the question, you have to hear the answer, and then you have to do something that makes the person who's answered you feel understood and validated and cared for. So it's not enough for them to answer, because your response to the answer is actually crucial. How you respond to the answer determines whether the person who's just disclosed something feels exposed, vulnerable, or feels good.
Yeah, and safe.
And safe. And that seems like something that, you know, a person can do mindfully. A person can mindfully say, hey, I have a question for you, and I'm listening to the answer, and I'm gonna let you know. There's things I can do to let you know that, hey, I heard you. I accept that answer. That's interesting to me. And that makes people want to disclose more.
And share. The one area that I do find that it becomes a problem is when a lot of guys fall into the friendship zone with women, because not that they allow a woman to disclose so much, but they end up becoming the shoulder that a woman cries on all the time. And then for women, they don't want to lose this friend that they can have a nice male-female interaction with, make them into a possible partner. So it, it, it becomes really confusing for both sexes because the man wants more from the woman who wants a relationship, and the woman wants a fantastic friend that listens to her and understands her. So I think there's also a fine line of how far you can go with that interaction, and it has to be reciprocal.
Such a good point. Now we're getting into the realm of stuff that's been studied poorly, or if at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, there is still, I think, relevant research here. So your point is, it seems to me, that that men who want a relationship can basically pretend that they don't, or pretend, oh, I just want to be your pal, your bestest pal, and that turns out to be an unsatisfying situation for the man who's not getting what he really wants, and for the woman who's really in a relationship with a false person, a person who isn't what she thinks he is.
Yeah.
So I think this the sort of intimacy process model that we're that we've been talking about absolutely says that for real intimacy, it has to be mutual.
Exactly.
And a man plays a role in making sure that it's mutual. So, you ask a question, you let someone know that you validate them, that you understand them. But that's not where the interaction ends. Now, a man can disclose something. And that what the man discloses can be honest, can be direct, can be the truth, which is, hey, this is what I want from you. I'm attracted to you. Like, that's an honest, direct thing to say.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the man only falls into the friendship zone if he lies about his intentions.
Exactly, and that's what I always say. Like, if you don't want to be friends, don't offer to be one.
That's right. If you don't want to be friends, it's lying to pretend. And that doesn't foster intimacy. That doesn't foster a true connection.
Exactly. It's manipulation, basically. On both parts. You're manipulating somebody else and manipulating yourself, too. And
that's right.
It's
horrible. And it tends to, ultimately, that's a defensive tactic, right? It's basically, I don't want to be rejected, so I'm not going to tell you what I really want. Well, if you're afraid of rejected, you're doomed.
Exactly. And then you're never going to get what you want because you're not asking for it. So it gets confusing for everybody else out there. How can they give you what you want if you're not saying what you want?
Oh, that's excellent. That's an excellent point. Everything about this intimacy process model says that truly honesty is likely to be the best policy.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean being insensitive to people. It doesn't mean walking up to strangers and saying, hi, do you want to go to bed?
Yeah. Take everything with a grain of salt that you and I are saying right now. Yes.
I'm just saying... We don't have to exaggerate. You can be sensitive to the interaction, but also be honest and say, this is where I'm at. This is who I am. And it seems like that's generally a good way to get what you want, be it a short-term connection or a long-term relationship.
Exactly, and that's what I wanted to also get into is your research for the Relationship Institute, because everything that we're talking about in the beginning stages of attraction. Ultimately, if it works out, you attract each other, you start a relationship, and that gets into longer-term connections, which is what you mainly focus on. And I'm fascinated by some of the research that you've done that I would definitely have to hear about, and I know that a lot of my users would like to hear about as well.
Well, it's true that the work we've been talking about is work that has been done primarily by colleagues of mine and other people who study relationships. And this is a field that really is only just a few decades old. The work that I've done says, okay, so now you're in a relationship. What happens next? Now, we know that the forces that draw people together are not sufficient to keep them together because people don't stay together for the most part. So relationships start out exciting, and they start out passionate, and if you're lucky, it stays that way, and good for you. But for the most part, relationships change over time. And the question that a lot of people have asked is, well, what happens, and how can we affect that change so that people who get together and are happy and want to stay together can stay together and stay happy over time? So what we do in the Institute, the Relationship Institute at UCLA that I co-direct with Dr. Thomas Bradbury, also at UCLA, is designed to tell couples about, well, here's what research shows helps. Here's what research shows is a good way to stay together. And generally we focus on three things that matter. And again, it's not rocket science. It's not something that's going to surprise anybody that's listening. But one thing that matters is understanding who the individuals in the relationship are. So understanding yourself and understanding your partner, where your partner comes from, were your partner's parents married, what are your partner's sources of confidence and insecurity, who is this person? That's got to matter.
Is that tied to being empathetic towards them, or is that completely separate?
No, that's not completely separate. None of these things are completely separate. But
okay.
Understanding who someone is seems to be a pretty important first step. And then, of course, there's the interaction. How do couples treat each other? And as you might imagine, there's treating each other in a way that fosters closeness, there's treating each other in a way that separates couples. And we talk a lot about that in the Institute, and there's been a lot of research about the ways that couples interact that bring people closer together or farther apart. And the third thing that is often overlooked is the circumstances of the relationship. The circumstances totally outside the couple. Some relationships are in a very supportive environment where couples have good jobs and they're healthy and they live in good neighborhoods and they're surrounded by supportive family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a much easier way to sustain a relationship than couples who have difficult jobs or are separated by distance or have to travel for work or if there's an illness. Turns out that relationships that are vulnerable in some way often can last a long time and be perfectly happy until things get stressful.
Right.
And that's when the vulnerabilities come out. I was reading a great quote from someone on relationships saying, when you marry someone, really what you're doing is you're choosing what problems you're going to deal with for the rest of your life. So when you choose a partner, you can think, oh, these are the great things and I'm excited about them, but you're also choosing what are your problems going to be. So you might want to make that choice mindfully. So the point that we make in the Institute is that these three things, the individuals, their interaction, and the stresses that they're under are all critical. And they kind of all have to go right, or you have to be mindful of all of them for a relationship to be satisfying in the long term. But yes, you have to accept your partner.
Definitely.
We talk a lot about a colleague of ours, also at UCLA, a guy named Andy Christensen, fond of saying, we don't have a line on our... We can't say, okay, I like these three things about you, but please change that fourth thing. Let's just point out that fourth thing.
Yeah.
No, we can't.
Your partner definitely can. That's a difficult thing for your partner to hear, and it's a difficult thing for you to constantly think.
Yeah. And this is also not the way human beings are built. You know, you don't get to swap out a module or delete that application.
Yeah.
You have to accept the whole package. So, first of all, understanding the whole package is a nice starting place. Who is your partner? Where does your partner come from? Why does your partner want the things your partner wants if they're different from the things that you want?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the issue of interaction. You know, we talk a lot about what are different ways that researchers have found couples successfully form a connection and maintain a connection. And there's been a lot of research recently on processes of not just resolving problems. There's a lot of research on resolving problems. You know, what's the best way to resolve a problem and stay connected? But there's also research showing, particularly nowadays, that it's really important how do couples capitalize on their good experiences. Turns out that even happy couples vary a lot in how they treat each other when good things happen. Imagine I come home. Honey, guess what? Something great happened to me at work. You know, like a project, and it went terrific. It went great. You know, I gave a presentation. Now you imagine that your partner can respond to you in a lot of different ways. Your partner can say, oh, great. Well, I had a crappy day today, and let me tell you about my problems. Which would be which would kind of minimize this good thing that I just told you.
Of course, yeah.
Or I could say, oh, that's nice. You know, I can just be non-committal. Or I can engage in a process that people are calling capitalization. I can use this good thing as an excuse to have a great time. I can say, hey, that's fantastic. celebration. Let's, you know what, tonight, cookies and massages for everyone.
I like that. That's actually really interesting because a friend of mine over the weekend, she and I went for a walk and she was talking about her boyfriend that she's been with for about 3 years now. And that is a very big thing for her. She just recently started grad school, getting her MBA. And when she walks in the door from school, her significant other doesn't ask her about her school day. Or when she goes, oh, my class was amazing, he goes, cool. And that's about it. And it breaks her up inside every single time. So then what would you advise if that's not a person's natural response is, oh, my God, that's great. We should have a celebration. How do you deal with that?
Yeah. Turns out that's a really big issue. And increasingly research is showing that couples who are able to connect over positive things do better over time.
Yeah.
So that's one thing we talk about in the seminar. Another big issue in our seminar is how do couples make meaning in the relationship? How do couples understand each other's maybe irritating qualities? Because once you get to know somebody well,
they have things.
Say again? Once you get to know somebody pretty well, you're going to know about their positives, and hopefully there are a lot of them. And you're going to know about their negatives, and hopefully there are a few of them, but they're going to be there. And it turns out that just like people have flexibility in how they deal with positive events in a relationship, they also have some flexibility in how they interpret negative things that happen. So, for example, let's say your partner, you said you have a date with your partner, and you're supposed to meet at 7, and you have tickets, and you've made dinner, and everything's set. 7 o'clock comes, no one shows. Your partner doesn't show. 7:10 shows, nothing. Your cell phone's dead, nothing's happening. And then finally comes sauntering in at 7:30, and dinner's cold, and you're late to your movie or whatever. Before your partner walks in the door, how are you feeling? Now it turns out that couples really vary in their likelihood of explaining negative events in ways that promote closeness and protect the relationship or inhibit closeness and hurt the relationship. So, for example, if my partner's late like that, I could say to myself, my partner must be stuck in terrible traffic. Oy, my partner must have been delayed at work, and my partner must have a dead cell phone battery. When my partner comes in, I better be especially nice. My partner.
Happen very often.
Well, I mean, it does happen in the happiest couples, but in other words, you can make explanations that minimize this irritating behavior, which is, no one wants to be stood up, and explain it in a way that makes you feel good about your partner. But of course, you're right. That doesn't happen a lot, and sometimes instead I can say, uh-oh, what happened? My partner's insensitive. What happened? My partner doesn't care, doesn't like me, doesn't love me. And then your partner comes in and you're already mad.
That's interesting. Okay.
Well, it turns out that, to some extent, whether you explain your partner's behavior as an intentional slight against you or as an unintentional external problem that your partner had to deal with, that's a choice. And it's a choice that has real implications for how the relationship goes. If you think your partner was stuck in traffic, you walk in and say, hey, sweetie, come on in here. Let me put you down. Put your feet up. I know you must have had a long day because I know you missed our date, and I'm sure you didn't want to. So tell me all about it, you sweet thing. Versus, hi, everything's cold. What happened?
Yeah.
The explanation.
It's still the same. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's still the same thing that you were talking about, the beginning interactions. It's providing a safe place. It's continuously providing a safe place, and that's how long-term you have a happy relationship with somebody.
100%. Really, that's an excellent way of putting it, too. That's exactly the way we put it at the Institute, is ultimately what we want from our partners, especially in a long-term relationship now, really exclusively, is we want the relationship to be a place where we feel understood, validated, and cared for. And to the extent that we have a choice over our actions, when we can choose behaviors that convey that message, relationships do better. Now, it's easier to make those choices if life is going well for us.
Of course.
If we have money and lots of time, it's easier to do that. It's hard to do that if I've had a bad day and I'm distracted. But that's the challenge.
It's interesting. It's really interesting. But I guess the longer relationship that you have, there's when one person does have a bad day, if you can consistently make your partner feel safe and taken care of and understood, then the one time that you can't do it,
you're more likely to be forgiven.
Yeah, exactly.
You're more likely to be forgiven and excused. Exactly.
So basically you're saying that it sounds like if both people have the proper tools, basically anybody could have a successful relationship.
I'm not sure I would go that far.
Okay. all right, I take it back. No, but
in the same way that I would say that just because I have the proper tools doesn't mean I could build a house.
Right.
But I have to have the proper tools to build a house. So having proper tools is necessary, but it's not sufficient. You have to have two other things. You have to have the capacity to use those tools.
Yeah.
We've done this. Now this research that I personally have done, where we took newlyweds who are happy, 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 and we follow them every 6 months for the first 4 years of their marriage.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And every 6 months, we measure them. And one of the things we measure every 6 months is how they explain their partner's negative or irritating behaviors. So the tool, of course, is try to forgive your partner, make excuses for your partner so that you don't have to get so mad when your partner is cold or doesn't hear what you say or doesn't seem to be listening.
Right.
The other thing we ask every 6 months is, tell me about how your life is going and the stresses that you guys are under. What we found is that the same couples told us they were making different kinds of explanations depending on whether they were under stress or not under stress. So happy couples generally excuse each other. They make excuses for each other. They forgive each other really well. That's what happy couples do. And the happy couples were able to do that. So they had the tools. They knew that this is something that they needed to do, and they did it. But when those couples were under stress, they did it less, significantly less. And when the same couples, after another couple months, were not under stress anymore, they started making those good explanations again.
Okay.
So the idea, what we took away from this is, it's not like some skill you either have it or you don't. Some people are better than others, that's true. But you have to be more than good at thinking about your relationship. You also have to have the space and not have the distractions to be able to do this right.
Interesting. That's very interesting work that you're doing. You must be fascinated all the time. It's like, I love what I do. I get to watch people and interact with people and make them happier with themselves. So you're doing the exact same work, so it must be so satisfying for you.
I tell people all the time, I've got the best job in the world. It's crazy that I get paid to do it.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely amazing. But I am going to wrap up now, but I would love if you could tell my readers where to find you, where to find the Relationship Institute, and maybe about one of your upcoming seminars.
We have seminars, lots of dates throughout the throughout the fall and winter and spring of this upcoming academic year, since we are academics. And there information about the seminars can be found at www.relationshipinstitute.ucla.edu. And that's Relationship Institute, all one word, .ucla.edu. And that's the institutes tend to happen at the UCLA campus, and they are open to a variety of different audiences. We have different kinds of seminars for different kinds of people.
Are they free or is there a cost?
There is a cost. It changes depending on the length of the seminar. Some of them are open to the public, but most of them are for a fee, sure, small, nominal.
That's amazing. And I'll have a link attached to this audio piece as well, so that they can just click through and research the Relationship Institute.
And there's a lot of information there also about relationships for people who are interested.
Oh, perfect. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I really appreciate this. It's always nice to talk to somebody, you know, with a scientific background to what it is that the Wing Girl Method does. So it's nice to hear that at least we're teaching the proper materials that people can use to find connections and create long-lasting relationships. So, again, thank you so much for talking with me.
Marty, my pleasure. It's fun.
Mm-hmm.